Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Charles Eichner. He is author of the book Nobody Turn Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we're talking about your book today on Martin Luther King Day, and later in the program we're going to hear Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, which was delivered at the 1963 March on Washington that you wrote about. But what's so interesting to me is that the book you've written is much less about King specifically and more about the many, many other people in the movement who made the march happen, a lot of whom are quite colorful characters and not very well known. So first of all, tell us about the process by which it was decided that the march would happen in the first place. How did it come to pass?
Well, the march was really a couple decades in the works. A. Philip Randolph, one of the great labor leaders, really, of American history, he's the one who organized the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. He wanted to have a march back in 1941 to put pressure on Franklin Roosevelt to essentially order that all wartime industries open up to black workers. And he organized a march, and nobody really knew how big it was going to be, whether it was going to be 10,000 blacks marching down Pennsylvania Avenue or as many as 100,000. But he so concerned President Roosevelt about this that Roosevelt signed an executive order banning discrimination in wartime industry if Randolph would call off the march. And so that's what happened. That was, at the time, the biggest civil rights advance since Reconstruction. But Randolph never really gave up the idea of a march, and he had kicked it around for a number of years. They did a number of trial runs in the late 1950s. And then as the civil rights movement was really kind of reaching a fever pitch in 1963, a number of people talked about doing a full-blown march on Washington. But this one involving not just black workers, but really a cross-section of America to make the case really for the whole world to see that blacks need to be given their full citizenship as Americans.
What was the stated purpose of the march? I mean, what's interesting is the civil rights bill was not yet passed, but there was some controversy about whether this was to be for a very specific purpose like that or a more general purpose.
Well, the original idea of the march, there were a bunch of different ideas for marches kicking around, but one of the first original ideas was that it would be a march for economic rights for black people, because blacks then and now have a much bigger unemployment rate and much more difficulty getting involved in industry and getting jobs and keeping jobs because of discrimination and because of last hired, first fired, and a whole variety of other things. So when Bayard Rustin, who became the organizer of the march, and Philip Randolph first talked about it, it was going to be a march for economic rights. But the civil rights movement was so busy during this period. 1963 was the busiest year of the whole movement, with about 2,000 demonstrations following the Birmingham campaign in the spring. It was so busy, and then in June, President Kennedy announced his civil rights legislation, which was by far the most advanced legislation ever offered, that the march organizers decided to really combine the idea of economic and political rights. And then the other thing that was important was that Martin Luther King really didn't want to do anything unless it involved the full range of rights, not just economic opportunity, but social and political rights as well.
Let's talk more about Rustin. He was an extraordinary man. People called him the American Gandhi.
Yeah. Rustin was one of those people who was behind virtually every major movement in progressive America in the, from the 30s or 40s on into the late 1980s. He started off primarily as a pacifist. He grew up in a Quaker community in Pennsylvania and became as committed to nonviolence and pacifism as really anybody could possibly be. And that pacifism led him to refuse service in World War II. And then he got involved in peace organizing, he got involved in union organizing, he got involved in civil rights organizing, and he became kind of the brains behind all of these different movements. And I think his greatest contribution was a deep, deep understanding of just how powerful nonviolence was. He understood that the only way to speak to a broad audience and also to dramatize the effects of injustice, wherever they might be, whether it's in the working place or in civil rights or wherever, was to speak and act nonviolently and essentially force the system to respond to you. Oftentimes it responded violently, and that dramatized as much as anything the injustice of the arrangement, whether it was war or arming or civil rights or labor rights, whatever it might be. So what Rustin really gave to all these various movements was a very keen strategic sense based on the concept of nonviolence. And he argued that nonviolence was not only morally superior, but it was also strategically superior, because you did not lower yourself to the level of the oppressor when you responded to violence with nonviolence. And ultimately, the only way to win rights was to cripple the regime in its strongest area, which was the monopoly on the use of force, Weber's old definition of the state. And so he brought this really sophisticated understanding of just how powerful nonviolence could be, and this is what ultimately gave the civil rights movement not only its moral authority, but also its strength in the streets, if you will.
And in that sense of nonviolence that he carried so profoundly, he was compatible with Martin Luther King.
Well, he was not only compatible with Dr. King, but he was one of the people who helped really educate Dr. King about nonviolence. Martin Luther King embraced nonviolence at a very young age. He was quite mindful of Gandhi, and he was mindful of Thoreau and the long tradition of nonviolence. But it was Rustin who was living in King's basement for about a month during the Montgomery bus boycott, and it was Rustin who really helped to school King on the many, many different dimensions of nonviolence. I think King thought of it as more of a moral stance that could have profound impact, and Rustin really taught that nonviolence was a full-fledged philosophy of action. It was not just a way to be better than your enemy, but it was a way to be smarter than your enemy. And I came across a really interesting recording with James Bevel during the course of my research, and he said in this recording, in this interview, that he considered nonviolence to be as mathematically precise as geometry. And when he first learned about nonviolence, he realized that if you put certain pieces together, if you take certain actions, if you coordinate certain people, if you plan certain projects, certain campaigns in just the right way, it was almost a fail-safe method of political action. And I think that's one of the things that Rustin helped King to understand, was that it was more than a moral thing. It was also a very practical, very pragmatic, and successful strategy as well.
Now tell us about Philip Randolph.
Well, Randolph, I think, was one of the pivotal figures in the 20th century civil rights movement, because what he did was shift the whole focus of the movement away from elites and toward the masses. Now, there were two main schools of thought before Randolph came along. School one, the old school, was Booker T. Washington, which essentially accepted that blacks would have to live in a segregated society and essentially taught blacks that they need to develop strong institutions on their own so they can build good, full, creative lives in the system of segregation. So you might call that accommodationist. And then along comes W.E.B. Du Bois, who, by the way, died the day before the March on Washington. And Du Bois was something of a radical who argued that the black community needed to mobilize to confront segregation, not accept it. And Du Bois came up with this concept of the talented tenth, where you would essentially take an elite cadre of blacks, the educated, the most activist-oriented, and you would mobilize them to confront the white power structure. But that was still just a minority of black elites acting. And Randolph comes along in the 1930s and 40s, and he says, you know what? Blacks need to mobilize across the board, because the one thing that holds blacks back more than anything else is an inferiority complex, what he called a slave mentality. And the only way to overcome that and the only way to gain your voice is to literally get out on the streets in mass and confront the government. And that means everybody, not just a talented 10th, not just an elite, not just people who are educated and who participated in organizations like the NAACP, but absolutely anybody who is willing to put their body on the line. Randolph wanted to mobilize them to confront the system of segregation and all the various ills of racism in the U.S. So I really give Randolph credit for creating a mass politics among blacks. And so it's really hard to imagine Martin Luther King existing, Bayard Rustin existing, or at least having those successful careers they had without Randolph coming before them. He's the one who brought mass politics to the civil rights movement.
And I so appreciate how much time and space your book gives to these people and many more, because it's easy to get focused, and I'm certainly guilty of this myself, on Martin Luther King and everything he said, and forgetting that there were all of these people who made the movement possible. So then we're going to have a march, and it's going to be pretty soon. And then they had to deal with the organizers. And King, as you write, was not even really so much an organizer as the inspiration and voice.
Mm-hmm.
But then, so you've got these guys, and then you have the NAACP, the Urban League, labor unions, socialists, communists, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, religious groups, militant groups, moderate white people. And they had to juggle all of these pressures and ideas.
Yeah.
And make this happen in a way that was peaceful and harmonious.
Well, and a critical part of that was A. Philip Randolph being the head of it. By that time, he was an old man. He was 72 or 73 at the time, and he didn't have the energy to really throw himself into the day-to-day organizing. But he was a figure of such stature. Absolutely everybody held him in awe and had great love for him in the civil rights movement and in the labor movement as well. And so by having him be the inspiration behind the march and the titular head of the movement, it gave reassurance to all the factions that this thing was going to happen, and it really had to happen. But it was the day-to-day organizing of Bayard Rustin that really made it possible. This was a guy who had been really unceremoniously shunted aside many times during the civil rights movement. I mean, this was a guy who organized the first freedom rides. It was called the Journey of Reconciliation back in the 1940s, long before the freedom rides of 1961. And he kept getting shunted aside, one, because he had had a brief flirtation with the Communist Party, two, because he was homosexual, and three, because he refused service in World War II because he was a pacifist. So he kind of had three strikes against him and therefore was not able to play the front and center role that he really deserved. But he understood that, and he had so many other talents as a behind-the-scenes organizer that he still became one of the really all-time greats of American history and of the civil rights movement. So he, with the authority and with the grandeur of Philip Randolph behind him, was able to pull these factions together, and he was just very pragmatic. He made lists day and night of things that had to be done. He recruited young people and paid them almost nothing. There were hundreds of people who just volunteered, and he got them to work from 10 in the morning till 2 the following morning, and he was able to kind of constantly keep his eye on the ball. When they needed to adjust, he was able to adjust. When they needed to be flexible, he was. When they needed to be stubborn, he was stubborn also. He was an extraordinary behind-the-scenes organizer as well as visionary of nonviolence.
We're talking to Charles Eichner about his book, Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. Give us a sense of the variety of people who came to the march and where they came from. I mean, it was a huge influx into Washington, D.C. via every kind of transportation.
Yeah, they came by bus, by plane, by train, by car, some hitchhike. There was one fellow who roller skated from Chicago to the march. And they came from every background. They were students and teachers and housewives and factory workers and plantation workers, every kind of person imaginable. And one of the things that struck me when I talked to people about this, I interviewed about 120 people who were there, and they all said that they had never seen so many blacks in one place, and then they paused. And they said they had never seen so many whites in one place, and then they paused. And I said they'd never seen so many blacks and whites together. And I think that was the lasting impression that a lot of people had. A lot of these people were fresh out of jail. You know, Martin Luther King at one point in his speech that I am not unmindful that many of you have come out of narrow jail cells. And so there were many who had been beaten all summer and who had suffered great hardship over the course of the year and over many years. And there were many who this was their first foray into politics. Some kind of wandered in out of curiosity and then got so inspired by the crowd and so inspired by King and by John Lewis and by Philip Randolph that they ended up devoting their lives to civil rights and to labor issues and education and every other good cause we have. So it was a diverse crowd, and, you know, people talk about King as a great leader, and he was. He was one of the transcendent figures of the 20th century. But one of the things that I think is really important to remember about King is that he drew strength from the people that he saw. In 1963, he had about 350 speaking engagements, if you can imagine that, in addition to running the Birmingham campaign and advising campaigns and movements all over the country. So he was interacting on a daily basis with literally thousands of people. And although King himself had his weaknesses, he had his blind spots, he was not always first in the front of the parade. For example, during the Freedom Rides, he was a little bit reluctant. But even though he was not always the first in front of the parade, he learned from whoever he was with. And throughout his life, until his very final hours, he was expanding his mind and he was expanding his heart and he was expanding his vision of what this country can be and what the civil rights movement can be. And that's why I think the March on Washington was so important, because it brought these people together who made King and who made Rustin and who made Randolph and who made Lewis. It brought them all together for the only time to express themselves as a collectivity. And it came at a really perilous time for the movement. There were many people who really believed that the movement was sputtering, it was running out of gas, the civil rights bill, there was no assurance that it was going to pass. And the movement needed a way of both intensifying the commitment, but also toning down some of the dangers of violence. And it was this march and the words of people like Dr. King that made this rally rise above just a gathering of people and into a kind of defining moment for a new American republic.
Let's talk about some of the other people, completely unknown people. James Lee Pruitt, he was a young man who was carrying an unauthorized sign.
Yeah. Jimmy Pruitt was a guy from Mississippi who had spent a lot of time in that jail for having participated in marches down in Mississippi, and he was a rather shy guy. He was only 18 years old at the time, and he was pulled over by a security officer at the march, and the march said, look, you can only have authorized sign. Yours is a handmade sign. And the reason they had this sign policy was they wanted to kind of keep the order. They wanted to keep out signs that were overly bitter or overly angry against some of the opponents of the movement. And even friends of the movement, they wanted to hold things together long enough to get this legislation passed. So Jimmy Pruitt brings his own sign, and the security guy says, sorry, you can't carry your own sign. Someone calls out, Jimmy, show him your note. And so he unfolds this note, which recounts this absolute horror that young James Pruitt had experienced that year. He was arrested. He was jailed for almost 2 months. They stripped him of his clothes. They put him in the most intensely hot cell apart from others. They greased him up. They told him that the grease was poison and that he was going to die. I mean, they overwhelmed this guy physically and psychologically with the hopes of breaking him. And he walked out alive, and he made it to the march. So the security guy looks at the note that describes the ordeals that Jimmy had experienced that summer, and he just said, you know, keep the sign, you know. And it was one of those moments that had a big effect on people who observed it, because here was a guy who gave everything, and his story was so touching that it kind of trumped any of the rules they needed to make the march a success. Really heartwarming, heartbreaking story that Jimmy Pruitt brought to the march.
Women were underrepresented in the leadership of the march, and they weren't the featured speakers, and this was its own little political storm.
Yeah.
But Daisy Bates was on stage. She was somebody I didn't know. Tell us who Daisy Bates was.
Well, Daisy Bates was someone who had suffered really severely at the hands of the segregation and racism. And her mother was raped and murdered when she was a young child. And her father had been the target of the worst kind of vitriol growing up in Little Rock, Arkansas. But what Daisy Bates's father told her, she later recounted, was that you return hatred with love. And, you know, this is a story that I heard over and over again about people who were treated so badly, and they were just taught that you do not respond with bitterness, you do not respond with hatred. You figure out a way to use love to overcome the hatred. And Daisy Bates took that lesson. She became one of the guiding forces behind the Little Rock Nine, the nine students who integrated Central High School in Little Rock in the late 1950s. And so she became kind of a mother figure to those young people who experienced their own really harsh, violent time when they were playing their role in the movement. And so she got a minor speaking role at the march, and she got the honor that she deserved. But as you said, there were so many other women who played critical roles in the movement. And in many ways, the women were the real organizers of the movement. They were the ones back in the churches and schools and beauty parlors and mortician's office and everywhere else who did the mimeos and who did the phone trees and who made sure that bail money was available, and they did all the logistics of the movement. So it was, in fact, an injustice that women did not get a bigger role. And it was, I believe it was really part of, you know, part of the outcome of the march that people started to open their eyes that, you know, that women were, you know, as much victims of discrimination as blacks were in many ways. And you know, the march opened people's eyes, not just about civil rights as we know it, but also about students' rights. You know, there was a big controversy about John Lewis's speech, and people tried to censor it, and in fact, he did change it at the last minute. And I believe that was the beginning of the free speech movement, which blew up a year or so later at University of California, Berkeley. There were so many issues and movements and people moving about the mall that day that I think that the march helped to crystallize a lot of these issues, and then they took them back to California and New York and Mississippi and whatever they called home.
What you said a moment ago about Daisy Bates and returning hatred with love, that's something you can't really do on your own. I mean, it speaks to the presence of a strong church and support of a community where everybody's doing that. And as you write, this is a time where most people were involved in a church, which is mm-hmm. not really the case anymore.
Well, it's not just churches, but schools and unions. You know, unions in those days were not just checkoffs. They were places where, you know, masses and masses of people in big cities like New York and Detroit and Newark and Chicago and even in the South, where they met, and they had an active kind of after-work life as well as active work life itself. And there were so many of these institutions that gave, you know, blood and guts to the movement and that really taught people about democracy and taught people about how to be an activist and how to raise your voice and how to deal with violence when it comes your way. There were also a number of half-houses, like the Highlander School, where Rosa Parks herself had been schooled in nonviolent conflict before the Montgomery bus boycott. And so, you know, I think your point is really terrific, that nobody just walks into a movement knowing all of the many skills that you need to know to deal with the conflict and the bitterness and the ugliness and the complexity of politics. You really do need a guiding hand. And those intermediary institutions, that's what social scientists call them, they really need to play an active role in shaping citizenship and in giving people the skills they need to be sophisticated participants in politics.
We're talking to Charles Eichner about his book, Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. Let's talk for a moment about Martin Luther King's speech that we're going to hear in a few minutes. He wanted to make a great speech that was like a Gettysburg address, and probably by historical accounts succeeded in that. And there's this passage in the speech that you referenced a moment ago where he says, "I'm not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells," and so on. He says, "You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive." How do you understand that unearned suffering is redemptive?
Well, I really think those four words, unearned suffering is redemptive, are the most powerful and most important words of that speech and of that day. Because King was trying to keep this movement together. It was flying off in all different directions. There were much more radical young people who were getting impatient with the concepts of nonviolence and equality and integration. Many of them didn't want to be integrated with whites anymore. They were splintering off into what became the Black Power movement. There were many people who insisted that blacks had to fight back violently, physically, when they were attacked. And then on the other side, there were a lot of white moderates or liberals who thought that blacks were moving too fast and they were too impatient. And not to mention all of the segregationists who flat out wanted to ship blacks back to Africa. And so King was operating in a really dangerous, fragmented time, and he wanted to hold the movement together long enough to get this civil rights law passed. And so he was trying to, I think these four words are such a sign of maturity and statesmanship on King's part, because he was speaking as honestly to his people as I believe any public figure has ever spoken to his people. He was saying, look, this is not going to be easy. There are going to be people who get hurt. There are going to be people who get killed. And this struggle is not going to be won without suffering. That's a given, and we have to accept it. There's no easy way out of this. If there was an easy way out, there wouldn't be any need to struggle in the first place. And I think this kind of honesty is what people yearn for in a leader. They yearn for honesty, not just that, you know, we have strong budgetary problems and we need to make sacrifice, but they want to know really what they have to do in order to reach some higher ideal. And King told them on this day, and there were a number of people who were quite critical and quite skeptical of King when the speech started. In fact, there were a number of young SNCC members, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee members, who were hanging out in the March tent, and they were kind of laughing and making fun of King, calling him Dalaud, which is, you know, kind of the critical name that the young people gave King. And they started listening to his speech, and they themselves got transfixed. And by the time the thing was over, they were hugging each other, and they were singing out, "I Have a Dream," and they were transformed themselves. You know, their own bitterness, their own cynicism was transformed, at least for a moment, by that speech. And, it, you know, King had that way with people. Even, you know, even when you were skeptical of him, even when you thought of him as being, you know, a figure from the rarefied environment of the black bourgeoisie in Atlanta, or a rarefied preacher who didn't have to work in factories, even when there were, you know, there was reason for you to be skeptical of King, he won you over, and I believe he won you over because he heard you. He listened to people, and he allowed himself to be changed by his experiences with the people that he met. And, you know, that's not the kind of thing you can teach. That's not something you can put into a leadership seminar. That's something that comes from the deepest part of the soul. And I think that's why we remember King on this day, and that's why he will really be forever an inspiration to all of us, because he understood that change is about something as deep as the soul, and it's about love, and it's about learning and being open to yourself growing over time. And King, till the very day he died, never stopped learning, never stopped transforming himself. And I think that is his true legacy, is that you don't just reach a point of of achievement and then hold on to that achievement and try to do the same thing. You have to constantly open yourself to new possibilities and new ideas and, yes, even new dangers. And King did that to the very end.
One does think, when looking at this time, the time of this march, which was so long before a lot of things happened, a lot of successes, a lot of movements, and how similar the politics at that time were to the politics that we're living now. It's as if the children and grandchildren of the people who were fighting with Dr. King and the people who were fighting against him and throwing rocks, they're still there having the same arguments in some sense. And it does make me think about the question of what is the legacy, short-term and maybe in the longer run, of that march, of that moment in history.
Well, I think one of the things that we need to kind of think about real hard is the difference in the kind of politics we have now and the kind of politics we had then. The civil rights movement was a movement for basic rights. You cannot and you should not negotiate for a right to vote or a right to assemble or the right to eat at a lunch counter or the right to rent a house or buy a house. These should be non-negotiable things. These are absolutes. And I think one of the reasons that the civil rights movement drew such enormous power over time is that it was able to make an absolute moral claim that blacks are as decent and as good and as capable and as deserving as whites are, and there's no splitting the difference on that. And I think what's happened since then is that we've moved from a politics of universal values to a politics of negotiation and bargaining and splitting the difference, and in a way that was natural. In fact, a couple of years after the march, Bayard Rustin wrote a famous article for Commentary called From Protest to Politics. And he argued that once blacks won their basic rights, they then just kind of became part of the scrum of American politics, where all the various groups, labor, women, business, various producers in various industries, just kind of get in there and try to get as many benefits as they can. And I think that was true. Once blacks had their rights, they kind of became part of the ordinary process of bargaining in American politics. But I think what we really need now is a return to some kind of moral universal values. And I think that education might be one of those issues. We need to get back to the core universal values. And I can't say what Dr. King would be doing if he were alive now, but I do believe that the moral core of the civil rights movement was in saying that everybody deserves the same basic things and that we all are different, but we need to have the same basic opportunities throughout life.
Charles Eichner is author of the book Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
And thank you very much for having me.
And we're going to now take a break, and then we will be back with Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Please stay tuned to KSFR.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, The life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination 100 years later. The Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity 100 years later. The Negro has still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hoped that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must be able to conduct our struggle on the highest plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. As we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our body is heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the city. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, we are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution. Yes. And staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is a faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
The I Have a Dream speech by Martin Luther King, delivered on the 28th of August, 1963. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.